Your conference is being recorded.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining our committee conference call. We meet every month on the second Tuesday of the month at 12 o'clock Eastern Time. We're so pleased today to continue our series of guest lectures for the our committee call. This year, we've had quite a variety of different perspectives and speakers, from researchers to those who work directly with families. And today, I think we have a really special opportunity to hear a parent's perspective of a story of love and adoption. And today's presenter, I'm so excited to introduce to you. She's a personal friend of mine. She wears the hat, several different hats. She's a professional audiologist, as well as a mom of an adopted daughter who's deaf. Shannon Elam. I've known Shannon a long time, so I know her former name. Shannon Elam is an audiologist. She's worked as a pediatric audiologist for 17 years and is currently practicing at the University of Colorado Hospital Hearing and Balance Center. Shannon and her husband adopted a child with severe to profound hearing loss in March 2016 after being her foster parents for 2 years. Their daughter Felicity is now 7 years of age and doing exceptionally well. Shannon, we're so happy to have you here with us today. So I'm going to just turn it over to you and let you tell your story, and we'll have a chance, everyone, for comments and questions when Shannon is done. Shannon?
Thank you, Janet. I'm excited to be here and tell my story. I haven't really told this story in this much detail to anyone, so it'll be kind of fun to be able to go through it and share it with you guys. Just want to make sure everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
You sound good.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll start out with a little bit about myself and a little history of where I've come from. So I grew up in small town Cheyenne, Wyoming, and the relevant part of my history is that about age 10, I joined a group called Hands in Harmony. And in Cheyenne, Wyoming, there's a pretty prevalent deaf community there, and it's rather large, and there's a following there of people who really participate in that community. And so at age 10, I joined a group called Hands in Harmony, and it's a performance group of kids of all ages who could join this group if you're interested in learning sign language and doing performances and kind of stuff like that. So we performed across the United States using sign language to music and different kinds of kids. It's all just fun, and it was kind of cheesy, but I loved it, and I learned so much and developed lifelong friends, and I believe that my life would have followed a much different path had I not been part of this group. So I thank Hands in Harmony for that, and I thank all the people that taught me so many great things about hearing loss and deafness and sign language and being able to incorporate that into my life. And then throughout college, I was a teacher's assistant for the sign language classes in college. I was a sign language interpreter through college, which helped pay the bills, but also helped me keep my skills up, which was something that was very important to me. And I decided that I wanted to do something with my life, with my career, that involved working with children with hearing loss and also allowed me to continue to use sign language. And so it just kind of happened that I went into audiology. And after graduating in 2000, I worked primarily in children's hospitals in Arizona and California, and then ultimately I returned back to Colorado, and I've been here since 2005. I've worked with kids of all ages, all types and degrees of hearing loss, and many different developmental challenges for the past 17 years. My passion is working with pediatric cochlear implant candidates and recipients, and I'm also a coordinator for a monthly clinic that Janet helps us keep going and running that works with kids who have hearing loss and possibly their developmental challenges in addition to their hearing loss. I love what I do. I love helping children hear, and I love working with families. So that's a little bit about me and how I got to where I am now. Janet gave me a few questions to kind of to keep it going and to kind of stay on topic. And one of the questions was, tell us about your training as an audiologist regarding child abuse and neglect. And if I was prepared as a professional when I first met Felicity and became aware of her needs, or did I learn as I go? And I would say that the training I received in relation to child abuse and neglect through college was quite minimal. It was mostly on-the-job training and learning from my mentors and my colleagues as I went. But as a healthcare professional, I know and am very aware that I'm a mandatory reporter of child abuse and neglect, and I knew that I would encounter difficult situations as a pediatric audiologist, and I knew I'd have to be aware and attentive to what was going on, not only with my patients in the clinic, but thinking about what might be happening at home that would be preventing them from getting what they needed. So with that said, I guess I'll jump a little bit into the story of how I became a mom. So I first met my daughter, Felicity, when she was about 18 months old. She was living in Sterling, Colorado, and she came to see us at the University of Colorado Hospital for a cochlear implant consultation. When I went out to the waiting room to greet her, she was accompanied by a large group of adults. The group consisted of her biological mother, her biological father, her maternal grandmother, her foster mother and father, social worker, one or two social workers, I can't recall, her CHIPCO here, which is in Colorado, is the coordinator, the supervisor for the early intervention program for children with hearing loss, and her CHIP. CHIP is Colorado Home Intervention Program, for those of you on the call not in Colorado, and her CHIP facilitator, which was the person who would come to her, the early interventionist would come to her home weekly. So a large group of people, and it was overwhelming, I think, to say the least. And I quickly realized that hearing loss was not going to be the biggest challenge in Felicity's life. And she was the cutest little blonde-haired, blue-eyed toddler, but she was kind of dirty. She was kind of unkept, and it was very obvious that she was delayed, even at 18 months, in many areas. And taking a history and talking to all of the adults that were with her at that appointment, they reported to me that there was a history of abuse and neglect. But the details were limited, and we were really there to talk about how to help her hear better and how to help her communicate and the possibility of a cochlear implant. Her hearing loss at the time was moderately severe to severe, and she had chronic middle ear infections and draining ears and chronic sinus infections, and they had diagnosed her with asthma, and a lot of it was related to the environment she had been in, as we have learned over the years that wasn't necessarily something that may had to happen, but it did. And so at that point, she needed to be healthy. She needed to clear her ear infections. She needed to use her hearing aids consistently so she had access to sound, and that proved to be a challenge with the environments that she was in. She also needed a stable environment, period, before we could recommend a cochlear implant. So at that point, we were just trying to figure out how to get her in a stable position so that she could hear and she could learn to talk and she could learn language. And that's kind of where we left it after that appointment. To give you a little bit more history, Felicity was removed from her mother's care at 10 months of age, along with her two older siblings. She went back and forth between foster care and living with her maternal grandmother until age 5. At age 4, her hearing loss had progressed further, and we reevaluated her at that time for a cochlear implant. At that point, she was still in her grandmother's care, and social services was in contact, involved, and pretty heavily involved at that time, and we felt that it might be a good time to reevaluate this. Her hearing had progressed, and there was supports in place that would hopefully help us get her to learn how to use a cochlear implant. We had several meetings with our team, as well as her grandmother and the social workers. Her ear infections had become less of an issue. She was a little bit healthier with regard to that. And so we decided to proceed with a cochlear implant surgery for her right ear at that time. We were nervous. We were very nervous about this decision as a team. And I'm still just her audiologist, but I was trying to figure out if this was the right thing. And we all know that a cochlear implant is not a quick miracle fix for hearing loss, and it takes a lot of work to learn how to use one. In having a stable environment and a loving family and someone who can help her at home practice and learn and have that ability to dedicate time to that is critical. So we didn't know if that would happen with what was going on and where she was placed. Her grandmother was granted guardianship at that time of Felicity and her two older siblings, but she had her hands full. So several months after her surgery, the three children were removed from her grandmother's care again due to allegations of abuse. She and her two older siblings were taken away and placed in different foster homes. And Felicity was again in another foster home. It was heartbreaking, and we'd gotten the call from the social workers and no idea if she was even using her cochlear implants, no idea what was going on, how she was communicating, how she was going to be able to develop language. But our team saw so much potential in this child, and we knew that the window for learning to listen, communicate, and learn language was just so rapidly closing. So we had another meeting with our social workers to discuss options for bringing Felicity down from Sterling, Colorado, which is a more rural area, down to the Denver area so that she could have access to better services or more in-depth, more intense services to learn how to use her cochlear implant and for speech and language development. So at this meeting, the social worker, this might have been another meeting later, a second meeting, another meeting, one of the social workers who was present called another social worker on the phone, and at the moment we were sitting at a round table, and it was the one social worker, her grandmother, her foster mom, me, and Felicity. And so the social worker called her colleague, and the colleague was on the phone, and just handed me the phone and handed me the cell phone and said, "I'd like to talk to you privately." So I stepped out of the room. I left from there, excused myself, and I said, talked about the preschool and how do we get her down to Denver to get her into a preschool this summer that can help her development. And the social worker said to me, "Well, we'd like to place Felicity with you." And I think I said something like, "What?" I had, over the years, told those social workers that had multiple different workers that please, I wanted to take her, I wanted to help her, I wanted to give her, you know, what she needed because she was delayed and she was behind and it didn't have to be that way. So multiple times I had said that. Never did I think they would actually take me up on it. Social workers suggested she come live with my husband and me for the summer in order to attend this preschool that she so desperately needed. We didn't know if it would be a temporary summer placement or possibly a permanent foster adopt situation, given that she was again removed from her grandmother's custody and placed in foster care. So we didn't know if this was, we're going to do this in forever, or if we were going to do this just to get her some help. I don't think anybody knew. And at the time, my answer was, "Well, let me call my husband." We had been married for 2 months, and I fully expected to call him, and he would say that I was crazy, and he would talk me out of it, but it was the exact opposite. And he was 100% on board, almost without hesitation. So I sat down so I wouldn't faint, and I gathered myself together, and I called the social worker back. All the while, they're all still sitting in the room, and I'm calling her back on the other social worker's cell phone, and I said, let's do it. She needs us. Let's do it. My husband's on board. And before we had any formal training of any kind, 2 weeks later, Felicity arrived on our front doorstep with her two social workers and a small bag of her things. It was 2 weeks after her fifth birthday. And she arrived. She was missing half of her cochlear implant equipment. She was scared, of course, as you can imagine. Thankfully, she knew me. She never met my husband, but thankfully she knew me. But she didn't understand at all why she was suddenly coming to live with her audiologist. As you can imagine, that was pretty weird and scary for her. Little history. My husband and I had never discussed fostering or adopting. We wanted to have a child. We never really made a plan for that. We had no training or guidance, like I said, to prepare us for what was coming. And after Felicity was placed with us, we had 60 days to complete the mandatory foster parent training through Logan County. And we did so. And I guess, moving forward, I guess I'll say that Felicity had a very hard time learning how to trust us, and understandably so. She had been through so much turmoil and so much uncertainty in her life that she behaved as if she had never had any appropriate boundaries of any kind, and this is at age 5, or any expectations of any kind. She was often angry and explosive, and we didn't know why. I mean, we knew why. We knew she had a significant past, but it was never something that was easy to know what triggered it at the beginning. And her behavior was unpredictable. She had epic meltdowns, we called them, and we spent long nights where she was screaming at us and refusing to go to sleep, and she would take her hearing aid and her cochlear implant off and close her eyes so she could shut us out, because she just couldn't regulate her emotions, and she just couldn't figure out. She was terrified, and of course she was. But we spent hours upon hours trying to calm her down while trying to keep her and ourselves safe. And she was really just trying to figure out her world as a 5-year-old who didn't know who she could count on or who was going to keep her safe or any of that. So one morning, about 6 months after she was placed with us, after an all-nighter of Felicity screaming, throwing things, hitting, kicking, destroying her room, you name it, I called the social worker and I told her that we didn't think we could do this anymore. I told her to start looking for another family who was strong enough to handle this behavior. We hadn't had a lot of sleep over the span of several weeks, and the stress level was quite high at our house. I was a wreck, and really thinking that we had made a huge mistake. And the guilt of thinking that and of wanting to call a social worker and say, I don't think we can do this, and to have to put her in another home, it was horrible. I couldn't imagine it, but I also didn't know at that point that we could do it, and we didn't know how to help her. It just seemed so insane. But the social worker encouraged us to stick with it, and that this behavior was really just part of her process. It will get easier for all of us. Just keep what you're doing, keep doing what you're doing, and it's going to get easier, she said. So we did, and we worked through it, and every day was work. It was not easy, and sometimes it still is. But we stayed consistent with our expectations, and we showed her that we loved her unconditionally, no matter what, no matter what behaviors happened, no matter how many sleepless nights we had. We showed her we loved her and that we were there for her. And it seemed like her behavior turned a corner almost exactly at about a year in. But all the while, she continued having monthly visits with her older siblings. And she actually has 5 siblings. 3 that she lived with, and or 2 that she lived with, and then 3 younger ones who are still living with her biological mother that she would have visits with. So all the while, during these 2 years where we were her foster parents, she would have monthly visits with her biological family, and every time she had a monthly visit, it would stir up so many emotions, and it was like PTSD that was re-triggered every month. And so we did not look forward to those visits, but they were mandated by the court. It was something that had to happen. We had no say in it. And finally, after being her parent, foster parents for, it was about 21 months, I think, the parental rights for her biological mother were finally terminated, and we were able to adopt her. So the long story that got us to a point where we have a child now who is a completely different child. She is a very, very healthy, almost 8-year-old. And she's doing amazing. We've gone back and forth about what we do about keeping her in contact with her biological family, knowing that there's some importance to having that there for her, and she wants it. She still wants to see her grandmother. She doesn't have any sort of attachment to her biological mother, again, because she was removed from the house or from the home, from her mother's care at about 10 months of age. But her grandmother, really, between her grandmother and foster parents, were raising her up until age 5. So she had no attachment to her biological mother, but she very much did to her maternal grandmother. And she still does, and she still wants to see her. So we go back and forth about whether we have visits every 6 months, or we have visits yearly, or we we're figuring that out, but I feel that the farther she's been removed from that situation and the less contact she's had, the more she's been able to thrive, the more she's been able to kind of blossom into her own and really kind of become more stable. So that's kind of that's an ongoing process that we're trying to figure out as she gets older. Another question that Janet asked me to answer was, what impacts were evident from Felicity's life in terms of her communication, her CI use, her language, her social emotional development and schooling? Because Felicity, I guess I would say, had such inconsistent hearing aid use and cochlear implant use for those first 5 years of her life, her language and her communication was quite delayed, and she was behind in many areas. Her speech was very difficult to understand. She had low muscle tone, poor balance and coordination, and in low language. She was kind of terrified by everything. She was very hesitant to do much of anything. She would not interact with peers, to the point where we put that on her IEP as a goal to help her interactions with peers in preschool and kindergarten, even at the beginning of first grade a little bit. She would cling to adults, to parents, to teachers, to therapists, and she would avoid interactions with other children. And I think that goes back to her history, and she was with her two older siblings. They were 5, 6, and 7, so they were close in age, and they were kind of raising each other and without a whole lot of adult parental supervision and guidance. So I think her interaction with peers definitely was a concern and was a problem at the beginning. She'd become very overstimulated quite easily, and she still does to a degree, but it's definitely improved significantly. She doesn't do well unless she knows exactly what's going to happen. She needs control of her environment. She likes predictability and routine. She has never exhibited any negative behavior in school, other than being tired and sad after nights of no sleep and screaming and horrible stuff at home. So at school, she's done well. And we think about these kiddos who have hearing loss, and we think about the gap when they don't have access to language and hearing. And she had quite a gap. And we think about these kids that were often just trying to keep that gap going, not necessarily having the high expectation of closing it, but to keep that gap from getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But that wasn't okay with me. I wasn't okay with her having this gap, and I wanted that gap closed, and I thought she had the potential to do so. And so we have worked so hard to close that gap to the point where she is now in second grade and performing at a second grade level. She continues to struggle a bit with high level language because she didn't have a lot of exposure to language for those first 5 years, but she's doing amazing. We work with her constantly. She gets speech therapy with an auditory verbal therapist. We're now down to every other week, but we were doing weekly for quite some time. And at school, she very much likes to have a plan at school. She likes to know what's going to happen. She asks her teacher at the beginning of the day if there's going to be anything different or unusual about the day, if there's going to be a substitute for half a day, or if tomorrow there'll be a substitute, any of that. She likes to have a plan. She likes to know in advance what's going to happen. And I know a lot of that comes because of her history. With regard to academics, she's made great progress, like I said. She, at age 6, she was in our care, but not, she was almost adopted. She was a few weeks away from being adopted, but we went ahead and proceeded with a cochlear implant on her second ear that same month. It was a big month. She got a second cochlear implant and officially a new family, so it was a big month, and we celebrate that month every year. She loves to hear. She is an excellent cochlear implant user. She is an oral communicator and learner. She knows sign language, and that kind of goes back to where my background was and knowing sign language and wanting. I want her to know sign language, and we teach her. We practice sign language. When her cochlear implants are off, I use sign language with her. When she's away from a distance and can't hear me, we use sign language. She's receptively really, really great at sign language. I sign to her, and she speaks back to me. She doesn't use it receptively that much, sometimes, but not that much. She's become an excellent advocate for herself, and we work on that every day. the teachers of the deaf at her school and the therapists are always amazed by that because they work with so many other kids. And advocacy may not be of theirs, and it's been my goal. It is absolutely a strength of hers. Another question that Janet proposed was, what lessons have you learned that you could share with a group in terms of supporting other families who have adopted children and or fostering and or supporting families who are going through this type of experience? This is a hard question for me to answer. I had to learn to practice patience when I was beyond frustrated and exhausted and sad and stressed and worried about her. It takes a patient and compassionate person to take on a foster child, and someone who has the ability to really dedicate everything they have to help give this child what they need when they didn't get it from others in their lives that should have given it to them. I would recommend that parents utilize whatever respite care you can and that you find others who can count on, who you can count on to help you through it, especially those initial, that initial, I don't know, 6 months to a year. We had a dear friend who also happens to be a teacher of the deaf and a former foster parent, and she was a tremendous support for us during that first year. She and her husband would take Felicity after school, after her half-day preschool, and until my husband and I could get off work to go pick her up, and they would take her for sleepovers at her house to give us a little break for us to refuel and get ready to tackle all that she needed again. That is a huge part of it, and I think we probably didn't look into enough of that or take other people up on their offer. And the difficult part about that when you're a foster parent is that the people caring for her have to be approved and certified. You can't just have her stay with anybody. So you have to have someone that the agency, that the social services approves and that is willing to help. So that was a challenging thing, but I think it can be done, obviously. There are support groups, trainings, of course, offered through these foster adopt agencies. We didn't join any support groups, and I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe we should have. I don't know. We read lots of books, and we listened to podcasts, and we relied on our friends and our family for support getting through that first year. But looking back, I mean, so many, because of the work that I do, I know that so many children need good homes, and I would say that I learned that it's possible to make a difference, and it's possible to push through these difficult times to get to the really good ones. And now Matt and I can't possibly imagine our lives without her, and we're so glad that we didn't give up on her, and we're also really glad that she didn't give up on us. We are now mom and dad, and we are a family, and it's kind of a crazy story, but it's amazing. And she is now a completely different child from when she first came to live with us, and she's one of the most loved students in her class, in her school. Her teachers adore her. Her peers adore her. Her interactions with her peers are now completely normal. She has play dates and sleepovers, and the school talks about how hard she works, how polite she is, how she follows the rules even when other kids are not. And she's just not the same kiddo that she was 3 years ago. She walks with her head held high. She is confident. She is independent. And most of all, most important to us, is that she's kind. She has a really, really heart. She's a compassionate little 7-year-old. It's kind of crazy. And she's become a leader. She tells me she's a total leader at school. And she tells me, Mom, I'm not bossy. I'm a leader. And I'm like, that's right. You're a little bossy, but I'll take it. She still has her moments, and she still has things that trigger memories that bring her kind of in back and take her back into a place where she doesn't want to be, but she's handling it. We did play therapy for some time. Most of the past couple of years, we did play therapy. She's not in any play therapy now. She's doing really, really well. We know that she will likely need it again in the future. But she's learned so much to communicate about her and control. And that's our story. That's all I had, Janet.
This is Janet. For those of you who are listening, if you're not speaking, if you could put your phone on mute, that would be helpful. Thank you. Shannon, I could just listen to you all day. Thank you so much for sharing. I'm sure it's just a piece of the experience that you and Matt have been through. And there's just so many levels to this that I appreciate you so much sharing with us today. It's just a fantastic story, thinking of the level of fostering of your professional experience and first encountering Felicity and then the transition to becoming her mom. And so we want to welcome you to Hands and Voices as a mom, and also thank you for sharing your expertise with us. I was just really moved. I want to just open the floor to other comments and questions from those who are listening in today.
Shannon, this is Harold Johnson. Thank you for your presentation. I so enjoyed listening and learning from you. I wonder, when stress does happen, when there is a flashback that your daughter may experience, what are some of the strategies that you and she use to kind of get recentered in this reality as opposed to maybe a past reality?
We've come up with a lot of strategies. We, at this point, right now, what she's doing, if something kind of bothers her, like, for example, she doesn't do well when she gets overstimulated, when there's too much chaos. And at a school assembly, it tends, like, school assemblies are something that just don't, she doesn't do well with. So school assembly, we have strategies where she doesn't sit in the middle of the gym. She goes to the back where it's not so noisy and so chaotic. And she has little stress balls in her backpack and in her desk and at home where if she starts to feel like she's kind of going to lose control and something's really bothering her, which she doesn't know what it is, but something triggers something, she'll use her stress ball, or she will, she's gotten to the point where she'll just say, I'm starting to feel like get a little crabby is what she says. And so she'll take some deep breaths, or she will just say, I need a minute, which is incredible for a 7-year-old to do. And I don't, she's matured a lot in that ability to do so. But we talk a lot. We're a family that talks a lot, and we talk about our feelings and we talk about our emotions. And we've really tried to help her words and language to communicate them as opposed to screaming and hitting and kicking.
Mm-hmm.
That answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And if I can do a follow up, that point of having the language to express your feelings and to talk through things, that's something we have in our safety checklist, if you will, that we try to get professionals to agree to have those worked into students' IEPs.
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting any pushback from professionals about them including, you know, your daughter having the language she needs to express her feelings, as well as in them accepting some of these strategies, like where it's best for her to sit, maybe as opposed to where they might want her to sit, for example, in the auditorium?
No, we are so pleased with her educational team and the support that we're getting from the school right now. We just moved her to a different school for second grade this year, and they have been accommodating and extremely helpful, and whatever we need, they are on it. And her teacher is phenomenal.
Thank you.
I know that's not the norm everywhere, but we've been very fortunate.
This is Janet. Thank you. Any other questions or comments from those listening in or joining by through captioning? We'll make a pause here for a moment.
Hi, Shannon. This is Lisa from Indiana, and I just wanted to thank you so much for sharing your story. It's very inspirational, and you guys obviously have made such a difference in sharing this nationally and internationally. I am very, very inspired. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
This is Janet. You can, if anybody else has any questions or comments, keep thinking of them. I have a question for you, Shannon. Thinking about, at Hands and Voices, we do a workshop sometimes called Is This a Deaf Thing? Which, as parents, sometimes we struggle with issues or behaviors or communication with our children, trying to differentiate between, you know, typical development of what kids might be going through versus the impact of the hearing loss or deafness. And I think we also have this conversation often with families who have kids with additional special needs, to then parse through whether those have an impact. So you particularly being an expert as an audiologist and understanding the impact of hearing loss, I'm sure it was different for you in terms of the parenting experience, but have you run into that challenge of trying to differentiate sometimes between adjusting or creating supports in school, for example, around the deafness part versus Felicity's history and impacts of abuse, or do you just kind of deal with whatever it is?
I think it's been challenging kind of parsing that out with her a bit. Like, for example, you know, she's comprehension and being able to retell stories and all that higher level language has been hard for her, but she can do it if she's, you know, one-on-one and in a quiet setting and has a little bit of support. And, you know, it's figuring out, yeah, the difference between, is this because she's distracted and thinking of other things, or is this because she's having a hard time dealing with a kid talking next to her, and is she having a hard time dealing with the kid talking next to her because of her past or because of her hearing loss or because of a combination of the two? And I think for Felicity, I think a lot of the challenges that come up with her is a combination of the two. And I think it's past and the hearing loss together. And it has been challenging to kind of figure out which is which, but it kind of gets to the point where it doesn't matter. They kind of, in her case, go hand in hand, and we just take it as it comes, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you. That's really good. Yeah. Anyone else?
Hi, Shannon. This is the other Lisa Kovacs from Indiana. There's two Lisas in Indiana. So our Guide by Your Side program, where we match trained parents with parents who have children identified with hearing conditions, many times they get matched with a parent who may be serving in the foster parent or considering adoption. Were there any particular resources, links, that you found especially helpful that you might want to share with us that then I could share with our Guide by Your Side teams when they have parent guides in those positions?
As far as resources for fostering and adopting?
Yes. Like, you know, so first of all, in the fostering, during the fostering time, were there any, there's so many resources out there. Were there any in particular that were helpful to you in managing that time and space? And then also, were there any ones in particular where it helped you and your husband go through the process of determining whether this was whether adoption was something you wanted to consider?
I wish I could answer this question differently. And I don't want to be negative at all, but I don't feel like there were any resources for us. And maybe it's because we didn't look hard enough, honestly. But the ones that were given and the ones that were offered, a lot of what we had were, granted, the agency that we worked through was, you know, 2 hours away. And so the community that they had trainings and the resources it was far away. And so we didn't partake in any of those, but there weren't any that we felt that were super helpful. And like I said, we read books and we listened to podcasts and we talked to other parents. And I think that was the most helpful thing to us. But as far as specific resources, I don't know. I feel like that's the problem with the system, and having those resources and having good resources available when someone jumps into something like this. I didn't feel that support. I didn't feel that those resources were right there in front of me that I probably could have utilized. So I don't have any specific resources that were provided to me at the time. We kind of went in and we were seeking out our own, but I they were just different books and articles, and I don't have a list of those. I maybe could try to gather them up. But unfortunately, I felt like that was a challenge and a problem with the system we were kind of thrown into.
May I interject? This is Sandy, also from Indiana. I am an adoptive parent, and I have a huge list of resources that I can share with the group if anyone is interested. I found a lot of information from the Empowered to Connect conference. There's just tons of information about connected parenting. There are Facebook groups available as well, so I'd be happy to share that with anybody who's interested. I also do coaching for adoptive families.
This is Lisa Kovac. Sandy, if you could send those to me, I can get those out to our
site. I'd be happy to. Yeah, there's tons of really great stuff, and it is unfortunate that parents often don't have access to that, and unfortunately some of the agencies don't have the right information, so I'd be happy to share that with anybody who wants that.
And this is Lisa again. Janet, also, am I accurate that we just this year started collecting data, and adoptive parents is one thing that we will have data on of parental experiences within our chapters? Is that correct?
This is Janet. Yeah, I think that is one area that we are going to try to create further opportunities. At Hands and Voices, I think we thrive in the concept and idea that we're all united regardless of our individual experiences. It's one of the things that has kept us all together. But we've also found that certain populations within our organization, such as parents with kids with special needs or adoptive parents, we want to provide some platforms for sharing and receiving resources. So this is a great conversation. And just between sort of what helped Sandy and what helped Shannon, I think that's the other thing that we all always think about at Hands and Voices is different resources and supports sort of speak to or work for different families. And so having a collection of different resources and also different people who've gone through this process, I think, is really important. So thank you so much. Before we're going to move on to a different topic. It has to do with this, but before I do that, I just wanted to give anyone else on the call an opportunity for a comment or a question.
This is Nancy from California.
Yeah, go ahead, Nancy.
Hey. And I just wanted to say to Mom that my sisters, who are both child development experts, assured me, because I had a challenging child, that children will save their most challenging behaviors to exhibit to the people they trust the most. And I think your story exhibited that, you know, where your child didn't, Felicity didn't show those behaviors at school, but she did at home. And so I just wanted to thank you for hanging in there through all those tough times. That exhibits a lot of strength and love on your part. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that, too.
This is Janet. Shannon, I think this topic for us as a community, we've been doing it for a lot of years. We approach it in a lot of different ways, but the motivator for having hope that the lives of kids who experience child abuse and neglect, that there's hope for them, not only in preventing this from happening in the first place, but also hearing stories of kids who've experienced this and gone on to thrive and have loving homes. So thank you so much for sharing your story today. It's just been a highlight for me, I think, in this series of thinking about this from our different presenters. So thank you very much for joining us. And we're going to be closing out here in just a few minutes, but I have one other thing I wanted to just talk to the committee about, and that is, as Harold mentioned, he and I are presenting next week at the CEC conference, and I'm going to be presenting on the safety attachment plan for IEPs and 504s. It's a plan that helps parents talk about the issues of safety in the school setting. For those of you who have been around for a while, we know that we've experienced both success and challenges in utilizing this attachment plan at IEP meetings. Harold intimated it when he asked Shannon about getting support in the school situation. And I would like to provide just a couple of really quick case studies in the presentation. I have two written down, but what I was hoping for today is if you as a parent have or a professional had an experience with the actual safety attachment plan during an IEP meeting, would you please email me at janet@handsandvoices.org? I would like to just have a little summary of more than the two, just to get a better sense of how this is playing out in reality as I present the safety attachment plan. So if you have either experienced using it or know somebody who has, or have any comments for me for the presentation, that would be wonderful. I would really appreciate it. And Shannon, I don't know if you've seen our safety attachment plan. It's a kind of like a communication plan, but it walks you through some things you might want to talk to your team about. We would love for you to look at it to see if we've captured everything that you've experienced and whether that would be helpful since you've had a good IEP team experience in this way. So
definitely
that would be great. Yeah. Harold, is there anything else that you would like to mention or any of our core team committee members for our call today?
Very quickly, this is Harold. Just, to encourage all of you guys to take the first step, which is breaking the taboo of talking about this topic, that, our kids are particularly vulnerable, but we can make them help them to be successful just by breaking this taboo and talking about the topic of what you learned today. So if everyone on this call shares something they learned today with someone else and therefore broke the taboo of talking about this topic, it actually makes our kids safer. So think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hi, this is Sarah Kennedy. I just want to thank Shannon also for sharing her personal story. That's not easy, especially when you don't have any visual feedback from a group like this.
True.
So I might be reaching out to you to write an article if you'd be interested. I especially would like to explore, how Felicity became more attached to you and maybe what the turning point was there. But I know we're running out of time here.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
Yeah, thank you. So all of you who've joined today, thank you so much. And as Harold said, I think for even us on the committee, when we first started, our first task was just to have conversations with people about the areas of child abuse and neglect, to keep learning. All of us who've been a part of this, our motivations come in different ways at different times. And knowledge is definitely power. And as Lisa said from Indiana, this was just so inspirational today, and I know I learned a lot. I learned a lot, too. I particularly was thinking about what you said, Shannon, around differentiating between the issues of hearing loss or deafness with behavior issues and Felicity's past experience. And you said something that really stuck out to me, which was that at some point you're it doesn't really matter so much anymore as it does in addressing the issues. And so I think even for us with typically developing or kids without adverse childhood experiences, I think we all can relate to moving through this journey with our children who are deaf or hard of hearing and trying to find the reasons behind why our kids are struggling in certain areas, but just to have high expectations and to keep working through it and patience and perseverance. So again, thank you everyone very much. Thank you, Shannon. Thank you, Harold, for your leadership and this committee. We'll be gathering again next month, same time, same place. And Harold, do you want to talk a little bit about our presentation for next month?
Sure, actually two things. One, for everyone to note that we have now a really remarkable conference table packet, if you will. So if any of the Hands and Voices chapters are having either a local, regional, state, or otherwise conference, please, you know, communicate with Janet, and then we then can send you a whole package from pictures to handouts to books to quilts. So it's how to have this conversation. Next month, Irene van der Zan, who is executive director for Care Power, will be talking to us about a topic she spoke on one other time, but is particularly pertinent now. And it's about how to plan for a safe, fun, and successful summer for your kiddos. So obviously school's ending, things are planning, summer camps, friends watching the kids, a whole array of things going to be going on. So Irene van der Zan from Care Power will be talking to us about planning and having a safe and successful summer for our kids.
This is Janet. Thank you, Harold, and thank you all for attending. We hope you all have a wonderful day, and we thank you for your time. Again, thank you, Shannon, and we'll be signing off now. So thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Janet.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 5 minutes.